Today is Friday, the 16th of July, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Afghan special forces are going house to house to clear districts of Taliban fighters.
It's believed the Taliban is spreading propaganda about how many areas they've captured to spread confusion and fear.
Plus, a new report from the United Nations shows that the COVID-19 pandemic has disrupted routine immunization efforts for millions of children. We'll have these stories and more next. The U.S. troop withdrawal from Afghanistan is raising questions about who will fill the power vacuum left in America's wake. In Moscow, Kremlin officials are skeptically eyeing recent Taliban advances and how they might affect neighboring buffer states in Central Asia. Charles Maines starts us off today.
With U.S. troops heading home, Russian officials are publicly enjoying the moment.
The U.S. is not just withdrawing troops from Afghanistan. They are withdrawing, effectively admitting the failure of their 20-year mission.
Russian President Vladimir Putin initially endorsed the U.S. military operation, in part because the American presence de facto resolved Russia's own concerns about a terrorist threat in Afghanistan. But with the U.S. now on its way out, analysts say the Kremlin is openly worried that renewed fighting and masses of refugees could spill over into neighboring Central Asian nations, allowing Islamic extremism to spread in a region traditionally under Moscow's sway.
Thinking about its own security, Russia has absolutely no choice but interfere in Central Asian republics in case the situation there will be unstable.
In recent days, Russian officials hosted Taliban representatives for talks in Moscow, with both sides seeking security guarantees. Taliban negotiators claim their fighters now control 85% of Afghan territory, but ruled out attacks on Russian military allies like Tajikistan, with whom Moscow shares a collective security agreement. Yet already several thousand people have streamed across the border amid clashes with Afghan government troops.
Okay, maybe Talib leaders are exaggerating when they say that they control 85% of territory. But their deployment on Tajik border is a real fact. They control Tajik border.
Meanwhile, political observers at home have been quick to point out the irony of the Kremlin negotiating with a group it officially deems a terrorist organization, even as it cracks down on Russian opposition groups like Alexei Navalny's Anti-Corruption Foundation and what many see as a similar extremist pretext to ban members from fall parliamentary elections.
Navalny and his followers would never be allowed to gather in Moscow. But if you're the Taliban, why not? If that's what the authorities want, it's hypocritical and cynical. Even the Taliban is allowed to do what political opponents of the Kremlin are not.
Having fought its own deadly decade-long war in Afghanistan in the 1980s that ended in defeat, few think the Kremlin is eager to engage again militarily. But as the American role in Afghanistan ends, the danger is that spiraling circumstances on the ground could force Russia into entering the void. Charles Maines for VOA News, Moscow.
Some fear the current security situation in Afghanistan could deteriorate further and lead to a civil war. In the 1990s, a similar conflict forced millions of Afghanistans to flee into neighboring countries, including Pakistan, which has hosted some 3 million Afghan refugees for decades. But this time, Pakistan is far more reluctant to take on more refugees. Aisha Tanzim has that part of the story.
Jeeva Khawas was only 4 when she came to Pakistan in the 1990s as an Afghan refugee. More than 2 decades later, she now feels more at home in Pakistan than the country of her birth.
That time I was a child, so I don't remember that much. But after that, I complete my matric from here in Pakistan, then college, and now I'm doing MPhil from university. And beside that, I'm doing job.
Unlike Khawas, Afsar Khan was born in a refugee camp and spent his entire life here. He works at a vegetable market for only a few dollars a day.
We want other countries to cooperate in the peace process so that peace is achieved in Afghanistan and we can return to our homeland. We are sick and tired of living in poverty as a refugee.
Some 3 million Afghan refugees live in Pakistan. Because of violence and insecurity in their home country, most say they cannot return. But if the deteriorating situation in Afghanistan leads to civil war, as some fear, millions more Afghans may be forced to flee their homes. This time, Pakistan is feeling less generous.
We are willing to help, but we are in no position to take in new refugees this time around. The international forces and the UN should make arrangements for them inside Afghanistan.
As a backup option, Pakistani officials say they will set up camps at the border, but they're adamant this time they will not let refugees into mainland Pakistan. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Islamabad.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has taken a step back and, after months of protests by professors and students, removed a controversial rector that he had imposed on a leading university in Istanbul. The school, Boğaziçi University, is regarded as a center of liberal thought and academic freedom. Dorian Jones has that story.
Boğaziçi University professors clapped to music in celebration of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's dismissal of their rector, Melih Bulu, by a midnight presidential decree. For months, Boğaziçi instructors have held daily protests against Erdogan's initial appointment of Bulu, again by decree. The university academics traditionally elect Boğaziçi rectors. Boğaziçi professor Can Candan welcomed Bulu's removal.
It is a result of 6.5 months of resistance, and I think it's extremely significant because this has been a role model for the whole country. If we resist peacefully and also in a very determined way, we will eventually succeed.
Police had violently broken up many demonstrations by students and academics over Erdogan's decision to impose Bulu. A large number of students have been arrested, some in dawn raids by heavily armed anti-terror police. The crackdown drew swift condemnation domestically and internationally, including from the United States. Teaching in English, Boğaziçi has historic ties with the United States. It's among Turkey's top universities, with a reputation for liberal and independent thought, which has made it a target for Erdogan, says Boğaziçi academic Seda Altu.
It has been targeted because of its liberal environment, liberal teaching environment, because of liberal student activities, and because that very liberal atmosphere has led many controversial and many taboo topics in Turkey to be discussed here without any kind of violence.
Turkey's government has been facing growing criticism over removing hundreds of academics from their posts as part of an anti-terrorism crackdown. Erdogan has so far given no explanation for his decision to remove Bulu, which followed a meeting of Turkey's higher education authority, where the Boğaziçi University unrest was discussed. Some prominent members of Erdogan's ruling AKP party had started to warn of growing unease among supporters over the government's stance on dissenters. Opinion polls indicated strong sympathy for the university protesters, even among some Erdogan supporters. Professor Candan, while welcoming Erdogan's move, remains cautious.
The struggle, in a way, continues. Just because he's pulled back doesn't mean that we'll be able to, all of a sudden, be able to elect our own rector. Struggle continues. But it is definitely a big success on the road to some real changes, not only at Boğaziçi, but also for the other institutions of higher education.
Students and academics are calling for a return of elections by academics of all university rectors' posts. It remains unclear whether Erdogan will seek to impose a new rector for Boğaziçi University. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. New data by two leading United Nations agencies finds the COVID-19 pandemic has disrupted routine life-saving immunization services for millions of children, many of whom risk dying from vaccine-preventable diseases. Lisa Schlein is up next.
The World Health Organization and UN Children's Fund report 23 million children missed out last year on vaccines against killer diseases such as measles, polio, and diphtheria. They say global disruptions of immunization services caused by COVID-19 have set back progress in childhood vaccinations by a decade. They report children in the Southeastern Asian and Eastern Mediterranean regions who are most affected. India topped a list of 10 countries with the greatest increase in children who did not receive a first dose of the diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis combined vaccine. The nine following countries are in the Americas and African regions. Director of Immunization, Vaccines, and Biologicals Department at WHO, Kate O'Brien, says new waves of COVID-19 and the rollout of COVID-19 vaccines must not derail routine immunization. She notes vaccines are the most powerful tools available to safeguard public health.
The world has rightly prioritized the emergency response to COVID-19. But if we fail to find a catch-up and catch up those who have missed their vaccines and restore and improve the essential immunization program, there is a serious risk of disease outbreaks that will continue to grow. We really can't trade one crisis for another.
Principal Advisor and Chief of Immunization at UNICEF, Ephraim Lamango, says immunizations in the first half of 2020 decreased significantly in many countries. This due to the closure of health facilities, pandemic lockdown measures, and transportation disruptions.
Later on recovery interventions such as the community mobilization activities and supply of protective equipment to health providers and conducting repetitive outreach activities had actually enabled some regions such as Middle East and Northern Africa region as well to really improve its coverage.
He adds the African region also saw a significant improvement in coverage. WHO, UNICEF, and partners are helping countries and regions in their efforts to recover from the pandemic and strengthen immunization systems. The agencies aim to achieve 90% coverage for essential childhood vaccines by 2030. If this UN-designated goal is fully implemented, they say the deaths of an estimated 51 million future children could be averted. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
WHO Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said on Thursday that investigations into the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic in China were being hampered by the lack of raw data on the first days of the spread there and urged China to be more transparent. Reuters reporter Colette Luke has more.
We are asking, actually, China to be transparent, open, and cooperate.
The head of the World Health Organization on Thursday said that investigations into the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic in China were being hampered by the lack of raw data on the first days of spread there and urged the country to be more transparent. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus also said there was a premature push to ignore the theory that the virus may have escaped from a Wuhan laboratory.
There was a premature push to, especially reduce one of the options, like the lab theory. As you know, I was a lab technician myself. I'm an immunologist, and I have worked in the lab. And lab accidents happen. It's common. I have seen it happening. And I myself had errors. So it can happen. And we need information, direct information on what the situation of these labs was before and at the start of the pandemic.
A joint report in March by a WHO-led team that spent 4 weeks in and around Wuhan with Chinese researchers said that the virus had probably been transmitted from bats to humans through another animal. It said that the laboratory leak theory was extremely unlikely, but other countries, including the United States and some scientists, have not been satisfied with that conclusion. China has called the lab leak theory absurd and said repeatedly that politicizing the issue will hinder investigations.
I think we owe it to the millions who suffered and to the millions who died really to understand what happened. And I hope there will be better cooperation.
Tedros will brief the WHO's 194 member states on Friday regarding a proposed second phase of study to research the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic.
That was Colette Luke from Reuters News. The World Health Organization has warned that COVID-19 is gaining ground in Africa, with the death toll jumping 43% during the past week. The WHO says the continent recorded 1 million new cases in just 1 month, and several countries are facing shortages of oxygen and beds for their patients. Mohamed Youssef takes it from here.
Speaking during a virtual press briefing Thursday, Matshidiso Moeti, WHO regional director, said Africa is recording its highest number of COVID-19 cases since the virus hit the continent in early 2020.
Over the past month, Africa recorded an additional 1 million cases. This is the shortest time it's taken so far to add 1 million cases. Comparatively, it took around 3 months to move from 4 million to 5 million cases. This COVID-19 resurgence is the fastest the continent has seen.
The Global Health Agency says 12 African countries are experiencing an upward trend of coronavirus, including Algeria, Malawi, Senegal, and Zimbabwe. Moeti says the number of Africans losing lives to the virus is high.
As this surge sweeps across Africa, we're witnessing the brutal cost in lives lost. Deaths have climbed steeply for the past 5 weeks, jumping 40% in the past week. This is a clear warning. Our hospitals are at a breaking point. In all, 153,000 people have sadly died. Africa is now just 1% shy of the peak in fatalities reached in January.
The increase in deaths is partly blamed on the Delta coronavirus variant that medical experts say is the most transmittable of all the variants. It has been reported in 21 African countries. Namibia is one African country where the total number of COVID-19 positives is on the decline. However, more than 1,000 people have died there from COVID-19 in the last month. Ismail Kajitae is a physician at the Ministry of Health and Social Services in Namibia. He explains why the death toll is so high.
A high prevalence of comorbidities in some communities, limited capacity in some districts and regions to manage severe and critical cases, and strong misinformation lobby resulting in non-compliance to public health measures, underutilizing of available healthcare services, and delayed complicated presentations to our health facilities.
So far, only 18 million people out of the 1.3 billion living in Africa have been vaccinated. Some African countries blame the slow vaccination process on the shortage of vaccine doses in the global market. Catherine Choktunji is the head of the African Population and Health Research Center. She says African governments should ask their citizens to follow health protocols like washing hands and wearing masks to limit the spread of the virus.
Other than the usual measures, the Africa doesn't have too many options without really having much of its population vaccinated. So the hope is that there's a lot of hope that in the next month, around August, many countries will receive at least substantial doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. But before then, really just keeping in place the usual measures.
Most African countries have eased health measures meant to combat the spread of the virus for economic reasons, and failure to follow those measures is blamed for the spread. Some African countries expect to get hundreds of thousands of vaccines in the coming weeks as the Aspen pharmaceutical company in South Africa begins producing 400 million vaccines. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA thinks it knows what caused a problem with the Hubble's main payload computer, which put the space telescope into a safe configuration and suspended scientific observations since June 13th. The space agency has been running test after test on the computer and its backup and have tried to resume normal operations since the breakdown. Both the main and backup computers are installed in the Space Telescope's Science Instrument Command and Data Handling, or SICNDH unit. From the tests, NASA determined that the power control unit of the SICNDH may be the cause of the computer's failure. The space agency says its Hubble team plans to switch to a backup power control unit within the SICNDH. If that solves the problem, NASA says the space telescope should resume normal operations within several days. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The South African government is sending some 25,000 soldiers to areas that it is calling flashpoints as it tries to stop violence from spreading across the country. Protests against the jailing of former President Jacob Zuma for contempt of court grew into civil unrest late last week. Mobs have looted and destroyed parts of cities, burning and destroying factories and warehouses. Scores of people have been killed and hundreds more injured. Darren Taylor reports.
None of us knew what was happening until it happened. Now all we are pleading with is that
government ministers, flanked by bodyguards, are touring ravaged areas. 5 days after the chaos began, their suits in stark contrast to the often dirty, tattered clothing worn by the people staring at them. People who just hours before the politicians arrived with platitudes and promises had participated in the biggest outbreak of public violence and disorder in the history of democratic South Africa. Soldiers are now streaming into areas threatened by mobs, but so too are vigilantes.
Don't waste your ammo.
Yeah, stop, stop.
Let them come.
Okay, let's go.
In this footage sent to VOA by a senior army officer, private citizens open fire with pistols, shotguns and rifles on a crowd trying to enter a suburb in the port city of Durban. The mobs armed with bricks, clubs and pangas, which are large, broad-bladed knives. Security analysts say this is what a country that's lost all faith in their police looks like. People feel abandoned by the forces supposed to be protecting them and are taking the law into their own hands.
Especially the looters. They're very smart, they're well informed, they watch the news. They must understand that tonight they're not only dealing with law enforcement, they're dealing with their match.
Young men hiding weapons under overcoats patrol the Maponya Mall in Soweto, near Johannesburg. It's the only shopping center here that hasn't been ransacked by looters.
They deal with their match because when they come here with pangas, our pangas will come out. When they come here with guns, our guns will come out. But what you should know is that we have enough firepower to last us until sunrise. We're ready to die. When I left my house, I told my mom...
Phoenix in Durban is a suburb populated by Indian South Africans. When a mob attacked homes here, community members fought back.
We have lost 15 people here. Police will have to...
Police Minister Becky Cele went live on state TV last night while visiting Phoenix.
People that murder people will have to be arrested. The problem of the standoff here is between Africans and Indian origin South Africans. That cannot...
The people of Phoenix say they didn't murder anyone. It was self-defense. They also insist they didn't kill the attackers because they were black. They killed them because they feared for their lives. The violence in KwaZulu-Natal has prompted Zulu King Misuzulu Kazwelatini to plead with his subjects.
It has brought great shame upon us all. I never thought after the tragic passing of my parents that I would see our own people so complicit and burning down the country. My father's people are committing suicide.
The violence began after former President Jacob Zuma surrendered to prison authorities last week to begin serving a sentence for refusing to testify at an inquiry into alleged corruption during his years in office. The inquiry has split the African National Congress, which has led the country since apartheid ended almost three decades ago. Zuma's supporters took to the streets, but the protests quickly turned into looting as a country struggling with more than 30% unemployment, constant power outages, and the pandemic boiled over. Chief among the many questions South Africans are asking today are, will an ANC government that's mismanaged the country entrusted to it by Nelson Mandela begin implementing policies that try to ease inequality and fight official corruption? And are sounds like these harbingers of what South Africa thought it had averted 27 years ago when the white supremacist government left power peacefully?
Yeah, guys, we not no time to play here. We're gonna do what we have to do.
Where's John with the shotgun?
For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Aid groups have been accused by the Ethiopian government of arming fighters in the country's war-torn Tigray region. Because of the allegations, the government says that it's considering ceasing some of the humanitarian group's operations. The Associated Press reports the accusations reflect the latest friction between Ethiopia's government and the aid groups. Humanitarian aid organizations have been trying to gain unfettered access into Tigray, which has largely been cut off. Hundreds of thousands of people face famine conditions, and millions more are just a step away. On Thursday, the pro-government news station ESAT alleged that the World Food Program supported fighters in the Tigray region. The agency responded by saying that, quote, it adheres to the humanitarian principles of humanity, impartiality, neutrality, and operational independence, end quote. And finally, 29 elite athletes from 11 countries comprise the International Olympic Committee's Refugee Olympic Team. The group will compete in the Summer Games in Tokyo that open later this month. As VOA's Laurel Bowman reports, it's only the second time in history the team of refugee athletes will compete in the game.
These South Sudanese athletes are among the 29 athletes on the Refugee Olympic Team. They'll compete in the Summer Games in Tokyo that open on July 23rd.
For the 29 athletes that I'm going to lead, I think we are going to, we will not miss a medal. We have also Popole for the judo. From Brazil, we have this lady from Iran who's already have a medal in the taekwondo.
The athletes hail from 11 countries, including Afghanistan, Eritrea, Cameroon, and Iraq. They'll compete in 12 sports, ranging from swimming and boxing to badminton and weightlifting.
My expectation to all the refugees athletes to do their best and also give the message of hope to all the refugees around the world because they are representing the entire refugee community in the world.
The Tokyo team was chosen from refugee athletes currently supported by the International Olympic Committee through a scholarship program. The IOC says it hopes the team will bring attention to the plight of the more than 80 million displaced people worldwide.
It's a message to the entire world to make the world aware of the magnitude of this crisis, which is growing every day. And it's also a message that these forcibly displaced people are an enrichment to all our societies.
A view shared by the athletes.
Showing the world that refugee also can dream and showing the world that refugees has goals. And even though they survived wars, they still are living their dreams.
It's just the second time in history that refugee athletes have competed in the Olympics. The first time was in Rio in 2016. Laurel Boomen, VOA News, Washington.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.